This is Kelly Krager conducting an oral history interview with Mr. Joseph Chizmadian. Today is 1 May 2014. I am in Lubbock, Texas, on the campus of Texas Tech University, and Mr. Chizmadian is kind enough to join me by phone from Port Orchard, Washington. Mr. Chizmadian, to begin the interview, I'd like to get some biographical information from you, if I could. Can you tell me when and where you were born?
I was born on March 18, 1944, in Rockville Center, New York.
What were your parents' names?
Lewis, who was my dad, and Anna was my mom.
What did your folks do for a living?
Dad was a machinist, and mom was a housewife.
What type of machinist was your father? Where did he work?
He worked in on Long Island, it's outside of New York City. Ford Instrument Company made various components for the military. And then later on, he moved into a company that made dry cleaning equipment, which was pressers, steam pressers, for clothes, for like tailor shops and clothes factories to press pants and coats.
I see. Was your father involved in the war effort, so the World War II war effort there?
During World War II, he was not allowed to enter into the armed forces due to his critical mechanical skills. They kept him at the Ford Instrument Company throughout the war period, making materials for the War Department.
I see. Did you have any brothers or sisters?
Sister older. She's 8 years older, and she's a mom and a housewife, and she was up in New England and still alive in New Hampshire.
Terrific. Did you grow up in the New York area, Valley Stream?
Yes, Valley Stream Central High School is my graduating high school. Grew up there and went to college at NYU. Got a commission in the ROTC, Air Force, and then moved on to active duty.
I wonder if you could tell me about your childhood. What was it like growing up there in the 1950s and 1960s?
We were rural area of a metropolitan, a large metropolitan city that was expanding after World War II. So there was a lot of housing developments and previously vegetable farms and potato farms and dairy farms that were being taken over and made into developments, homes. And the first large-scale commercial development of a planned community was Levittown. And that was to the east of us, that was out on Long Island. So a lot of growing up and a lot of growing and a lot of people moving into the area, moving from the city out to the area, out to the suburbs.
Yeah, yeah. What about your childhood? What sort of things did you like to do growing up?
Well, we were spoiled because we had a half-acre empty lot behind us. It was our kind of terrain. So a lot of tree climbing, a lot of forts, a lot of simulated cowboy Indian fights, swinging on ropes. Then school was only about 6-8 blocks away, so as we got older, we played a lot of baseball, softball at school. So pretty much within shouting distance of the house, and the rules were, the streetlights came on, you were home.
Right. Right.
You didn't push that luck because that would cut you down for your mobility. So that's pretty much the rule of those days.
Right. Tell me about your schooling there in New York.
Grammar school, was 6 blocks away. And then junior high and high school was probably a mile. And walked to it from school. Very few cars. Most of the moms were walking moms. They were not the car driving moms in those days.
Were there any particular subjects in school that that you gravitated toward?
Pretty much a math guy. Liked the sciences. Pretty much stayed in a pre-college prep course right through high school to my college entrance. So didn't take any technical shop skills after eighth grade. All senior high school was all academics. No practical auto shop or electric shop or any of that kind of stuff. So economics and physics and chemistry, math, the basic core subjects.
Yeah. What was it like growing up there in the 50s and 60s in terms of, you know, the Cold War as the backdrop growing up? What sort of things do you remember about the Cold War?
Other than the threat, the Steel Curtain threat from, you know, the Russians and taking over Europe, and the fears that we had that they were going to just run right through Germany and take it all over. My mom's brothers and sisters still lived in Hungary, so there was some contact through her on the family of that. They had property, I guess, on the Czech border. I have never met my my close relatives there, like my cousins or my uncles and aunts, so I don't know much about the family, but I know my mom kept contact with them, and of course they were always asking for clothes and any kind of help that we could give them.
That's really interesting, and a story that probably doesn't get told or recorded often enough, looking at what's going on behind the Iron Curtain. When did you graduate from high school?
1962.
In 1962, so this is the kind of the era of Kennedy.
Yes.
What was you and your family's opinions of the Kennedy presidency?
Well, I guess we were kind of supportive in the sense of a, you know, East Coast type president who grew up pretty much on the New England and East Coast thinking area. Not much connection with California or the Midwest, but it was pretty sad when he got assassinated in Dallas. It was kind of a big turmoil because really nobody knew the succession and how it was going to be. And then, of course, Johnson being from Texas, it kind of made a lot of people think about what was going on.
Yeah, yeah. Where were you when Kennedy was assassinated, when you received word?
Going to school. Mm-hmm. I was at school when they announced it on the PA system.
Hmm. Interesting. Did you have any plans for your post-high school life? Did you want a job? Did you want to go to school? What was going to be your path?
Well, I guess about late grammar school, maybe sixth grade or so, I decided I wanted to go look about airplanes and go fly in the sky. And so I kind of started hanging out and going places where I would see airplanes, you know, ride the bike down to the airport along the fence and watch airplanes. We had a small little airport in town, plus Idlewild, which turned into Kennedy Airport, was only like 7 miles away, so it wasn't really that hard a bike trip to go over there and see all the big airplanes going international. And then I joined, in high school, I joined Civil Air Patrol and started flying with them in their little airplanes out at Zons Airport, Amityville, Long Island, and that used to get my dad up on Saturdays, and sure he really looked forward to getting up every Saturday morning at 6 o'clock and driving me out there, but he was a good soul, and as I got older, he finally got me the permission to drive the car, so all of us either went with somebody else's car or their dad, or I drove, and two or three of us always went out there at least once a month, maybe twice a month to fly.
What did the Civil Air Patrol mean to you? What was going on in Civil Air Patrol during the 50s, 1960s?
Pretty much preparing you for military life, flying airplanes in a military environment. They gave us orientation flights in military airplanes. They gave us tours of the bases. Mitchell Air Force Base was still winding down. It was still sort of there. So we got a chance to see some of that. That was very historical. Around New York, there's Stewart Air Force Base and McGuire Air Force Base and Suffolk County Air Force Base. So it's a taste of the military aviation in the Air Force world. And CAP taught you the skills, the various parts of aviation, of operating aircraft, and the sciences that were involved in it. So it was a good introduction.
Yeah, it sounds like you had this interest very early on then.
Yes.
You mentioned that you went to New York University. Why NYU?
ROTC scholarship. They were offering that to us, and we tested it and got one. So it wasn't a whole lot of money, but between the university scholarships and dad's, you know, savings of the college fund, myself working in the summer, we managed to pay all the bills and didn't owe any money, so I was able to afford it. But the big thing was that they had the ROTC program that I could get my commission.
Mm-hmm. When did you enter NYU?
1964, and graduated in 68.
All right. Tell me about the environment at New York University when you were there. What was it like to be on campus there in the mid-60s?
Urban campus in a big city. Didn't have a lot of grounds to stroll. Manhattan was our campus. NYU is a large commuting college. A lot of people drive in every day to school. There is dormitories and residences, but they're spread out all over New York from Wall Street all the way up to Columbia Heights, University Heights up by the Hudson River in northern Manhattan Island. So it's a large campus. Got many schools, being it's a university. It's got law school and liberal arts and graphics and arts and sciences. So you get a pretty broad education. Plus, it's big on supporting the Wall Street financial area. So accounting and finance is a one big strong school there at the Washington Square campus.
Mm-hmm. Did you still gravitate toward the sciences?
Pretty much. Kept my interest in industrial management, which was really a time and motion study, critical path, production planning. Today we do that with a timeline. We do that with integrated activities from the various disciplines and having to meld them all together so that you have raw materials, labor, assembly, and distribution all in a planned activity.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned that ROTC was going to be an important component to your education. You're preparing yourself for military life. Was this Air Force ROTC, I assume?
Yes, it was.
Mm-hmm. And how'd you do in ROTC?
Well, I started out as a, I guess we had about 250 of us in the lower ROTC, first 2 years, we call the introductory program, and about 75 were in the last 2 years. And the reason for that was is that if you took ROTC, you didn't have to take gym. So a lot of students took ROTC for 2 years and then dropped it. Those of us that continued on, of course, got to be various leadership positions, company commanders and group commanders, and ultimately a wing commander, since we had two campuses and two organizations. That was one of, I guess, my highlights in the ROTC world, that I was a cadet commander and graduated, a distinguished graduate, due to my efforts in going through the program and doing well in it.
Outstanding. Now, entering the university in 1964, of course, American commitment to Vietnam begins to increase substantially during this era. What do you remember as a student at NYU and ROTC cadet there? What do you remember about what was going on in Vietnam and the reaction to it on campus?
Well, the buildup, of course, with the escalation, seemed like every 6 months we could take another 50 or 60,000 men and put them in uniform and put them over there. The expansion of the Navy's role, expansion of the Army on the ground, boots on the ground, the Marines, of course, all of that affected many, many lives. The draft was going on. Of course, that stimulated a lot of people to stay in school. But as long as they could stay in school and get their decent grades, they were exempted from military service until they graduated. So there's a lot of people just hanging on school, just going to school to go to school. But it was dramatic in a sense of there was protests, of course. There was peace movement, the peaceniks, the peace sign. If I remember correctly, it was Jerry Rubin in Columbia. They actually came to NYU and tried to stop us from going to classes. I was accosted by a group of them and told not to go to school, and I looked at them and said, "You're saying that you want the right not to go to war, and I'm asking for the right to go to education, but you're denying me my right." So I was able to persuade them to let me go through forcibly, and we didn't have a confrontation, but we came pretty close. It could have gotten a little ugly, but fortunately, with cooler heads prevail, we did not go crazy. But they insisted on coming down and disrupting our school. There weren't students there. They were just causing press coverage and looking for notoriety.
What were your thoughts at this time about the protest and their efforts? Was this something that made sense to you? You understood where they were coming from? You didn't understand where they were coming from? What was your opinion of that?
Well, as a student at that time, we were pretty much looking at being formative in the sense that we really didn't have opinions in the political arena. We were just pretty much doing what we're supposed to do. This is our goal was to graduate. Our goal was to get commissioned. So we did what we needed to do to follow the rules. These people felt that they could change the rules mid-course and to fit their own convenience. Now, without regarding what does that doing to other people's lives, you know, it's one thing to do your own life, control your own destiny, but when your actions take over and change other people, it's pretty formative, and you've got a responsibility to that. And I guess they didn't care, and so we had to suffer for it. It affected the campus life. It affected our government. It affected a lot of people. There's a lot of animosity.
Yeah. What did you know about what was going on in Southeast Asia? Did you pay attention to the events there?
Well, in the Air Force world, we were looking at the various airplanes that were being used and some of the tactics and equipment that was available for the fighting man, and we were, of course, going to be one of them pretty soon. So I think we all studied and read and watched whatever we could on TV about what was going on and how it was going on. Even though you graduate as a second lieutenant, you are not a trained warrior to go do anything. You still have to go to warrior school, which means you've got to find a specialty area. I wanted to fly airplanes, so I went to pilot training, and that takes a year. And then after you learn to get your wings, as you know, at Lubbock, they used to do that, you still couldn't do anything, because all you learned to fly was a trainer. Then you had to go to another school to learn how to fly a fighter or a bomber or a transport airplane. So it was quite a stretched out period of time that went on, and as we learned more about what we were going to do, I guess we were better prepared.
Yeah. You mentioned that you were following the war, at least to some degree. Did you have any opinion on how the war was being prosecuted at the time?
Well, the complaints were always that disjointed Washington was calling the shots, and the guys in the field knew what was going on, but they weren't allowed to do what they wanted to or how they wanted to do it. So it was kind of demoralizing in that sense that we were not a united front, even within the military. And of course, the civilian population was split. Some supported very strongly, said it was our duty. It was our country. That was the decision. It was made by our country. We needed to follow those decisions. I'd say we're pretty well up to it. We talked about it at breaks and talked about it at various student meetings. I did hear some lecturers come in to the university as seminar leaders, talk to us about some of the things that were going on. And the really kind of off-the-wall thing was going on was that we were still very heavily involved in sending a man to the moon while all this war was going on.
As news coverage continues to come in to the United States, I mean, this is something that was really unprecedented in terms of, you know, the Vietnam War is being brought to you, you know, at the 5:30 news or whatever it may have been. Do you recall the news coverage, the media coverage of the war?
Oh, yeah, Walter Cronkite and some of those people were there on the scenes. CBS News and their daily news bursts were pretty much putting the war on almost as soon as it happened. As I understand it, even some of the casualties, they were portrayed on the television before the families even knew about it. So it was kind of a shock in that sense that coverage was so wide open. And, of course, what we found out was how misquoted a lot of the correspondents sent their dispatches, and what you said and what they wrote and what they set out as people's opinions varied drastically. When I got there, of course, one of the things was don't talk to any reporters because you're not going to win. The discussion is going to be ugly, and you're going to look like come off as a fool. So we pretty much just left them alone, didn't really contact or really volunteer much information to them.
Yeah. The big event of the Vietnam War in 1968, the year that you graduated from the university, was, of course, the Tet Offensive in January, February, and even into March of 1968. What do you recall about the Tet Offensive?
I think it was a surprise. I think the military did not expect such a widespread across-the-country attack. And militarily, I think the North Vietnamese and the Viet Cong really blew it. They extended themselves way, way too thin. But they won it because of the shock to the American society that this small little upstart war could take so many casualties so fast, so much could happen so quickly. I don't think anyone was prepared to see that widespread devastation. And, of course, Saigon with the pictures of the guys at the embassy and the gates being blown up and all the carnage in the city, I think that shocked a lot of people into, let's get out of here. Let's get out of this war.
Mm-hmm. As a college senior, do you recall the coverage being that the United States had lost in the Tet Offensive? Or was it more, hey, let's take this for what it is, look at the numbers, see how this thing turns out? How was it portrayed to you?
I think the press made it as a loss. The military discussed it tactically as a win, and society as a whole put it all down because they didn't think the war should ever escalate to that level. We, in many ways, were questioned on our, really, what are we doing there, our involvement, why are we there? The domino effect that Eisenhower talked about, I don't really think played in well. It was there, it was discussed, but nobody really bought into it. But, of course, talking to fellows who were there, and who actually worked with the Vietnamese and the Cambodians and the Laotians, they could see it actually happening. But Washington seemed to think that all you had to do was knock out a platoon or a squad, and you won that battle. Well, if you didn't pacify and occupy and safeguard the hamlet, the next day, the next night, it went back to the hands of the enemy. So we kept doing that over and over and over again, a very demoralizing, very dispirited activity. Nobody really knew why we were doing it.
Mm-hmm. What was your opinion on it?
I thought it was an Army problem. I think from the standpoint of what I was learning and what I was involved in, I really wasn't politically astute to what was going on. I kind of gave up that to the higher-ranking people. If they thought it was the right thing to do or how to proceed, I kind of acquiesced. Maybe my immaturity, I guess, maybe is my gullibility. I thought they were qualified to do what they were supposed to do, and I gave it to them to kind of set the pattern. I found out later on that I was misthinking that way. They were not any smarter than I was. And in many cases, they were wrong, but they had their own agendas, and they were going to pursue their own agenda. It didn't matter right or wrong. So I guess life experience teaches you that you can't always trust those that step before you because they could be walking the wrong path.
Graduate, I guess it would be the spring semester, is that right, of 1968?
June.
June of 1968, okay. You graduate, you're a second lieutenant in the Air Force. You've had some flight training, I guess, going all the way back to Civil Air Patrol, etc. What did you want to do with your military career? You obviously want to fly. What types of planes did you want to fly?
Well, you know, I grew up in Long Island. Republic Aviation was there, and some of the fellows that I flew with and hung out at the airport with were either sons or there were people who worked at Republic and built the 105. So they all kind of steered me to that was the airplane you wanted to go. It was the technically advanced. It was the machine of the day. And I was looking at a career maybe flying F-4s or F-105s as a fighter-bomber pilot, as opposed to tanker or commercial transport pilots. So that's what my focus was, is to get through flight school and get a chance to fly a fighter.
Okay, so you want to be a fighter pilot. When you graduate, where do you go to receive this training?
From NYU, you go to Craig Air Force Base, Selma, Alabama.
Mm-hmm. Tell me about your time there.
And it's been a year. Since I already had gone through the ROTC flight training, they gave us a short course in a propeller airplane. For the full course, it was 3 months. For us, we only spent 1 month in it, and moved on into a twin-engine little trainer called a T-37 Tweet. Flew that for about 65, 70 hours, and then got into T-38s, which is a two-seater supersonic trainer, and flew that for about 120 hours. So it was a full 13 months of active training every day, very concentrated, very directed, very organized. You were pretty much just going through day by day by day by day, step by step, very organized pattern. So not a whole lot of thinking going on, just reacting and learning and responding.
I wonder if you could tell me about the trainers you flew there. Tell me about the T-37 and the T-38.
37 was a fun little airplane. Squealed very, very hurtfully for your ears. Anytime you were around the flight line where they were, you had to have ear suppression. A lot of the mechanics who worked out in the flight line all day long, they all had hearing losses from the screech of the engine. And a lot of the instructors wound up having hearing losses also, but it was just the nature of the beast of how it was designed and the engine intakes. But it was a pretty simple airplane to fly. It it gave you a good orientation on jet response to propeller response airplane. It didn't accelerate quite as quickly. It took a little time for the engine to spool up. It cruised about 260, 270 knots, which was getting up into high performance areas. But it gave you all the tools you needed to be able to fly the airplanes formation-wise, instrument-wise, and some acro. So you could do barrel rolls and loops and aileron rolls, mm-hmm. things like that. So it was an acrobatic airplane. And it prepared, I thought it was a good stepping stone to the T-38. T-38 was a quicker airplane, Mach 1.2. It gave us long cross countries, gave us long navigational abilities, I'm talking 1,000 miles, legs, that type of thing. So it gave us all the tools we needed to be able to function in the airspace throughout the United States. Plus, it gave us the transition for supersonic flight, which, if you haven't done it before, it's the difference between driving a Ferrari and a Cadillac.
How did you take to the flying there, both the T-37 and T-38?
I was kind of in the middle of the class. My academics are pretty strong. I was probably in the top 10. My flying skills and flying grades were pretty much middle to a little upper middle school. So when I graduated, my class rankings were top quarter, top 25%.
Yeah. How would you rate your training there, the instructors, the academics, all of that? How would you rate them?
Boy, that was a comparison of people's personalities that were unbelievable. There were instructors there that had never been in combat. There were instructors there that had 1,000 hours of combat. So, wide, wide world of experience and attitudes. The guys who went right from pilot training to instructors, who stayed there at the base, a lot of them, felt resentful of the fact that they didn't get an opportunity to go to combat. And so they kind of had an attitude about, I'm stuck here, woe is me, they don't want me really, here I am, hanging out. They were looking to finish their 3 or 4 years there and move on. Then the guys that came back from combat, some of them felt they were being underutilized because of the combat experience and felt they should be in combat aircraft in Europe or teaching at, you know, at the combat levels of Eglin and Nellis Air Force Base, and not some little podunk airport in Alabama. So it's getting used to again. You know, the people, some wanted to be there. Some were very happy there. They were content, no TDYs, pretty much stay there all 5 days a week. Weekends are only for catch-up. So it's kind of a civilian schedule, not a lot of night stuff. So they were happy. They were content. And we were exposed to various different opinions and styles of teaching, from screamers to at people that kind of whispered in your ear. Some of the best instructors were the guys that would just let you fly and learn on your own. They didn't try to push you. Some of the worst instructors couldn't understand why you couldn't do something simple. To them, they saw it as a second nature thing and couldn't understand why you couldn't pick it up. So just by saying to somebody you're assigned as an instructor doesn't really make them instructors. Mm-hmm. So the students have that reaction to that kind of involvement. If a guy constructs and he has good personal skills and he knows how to talk to you and pass the information, it's fun. But you get a screamer and a yeller and an impatient person, and you just kind of regret every morning you get up in the morning going, oh no, I got to go with this guy again. So it's, like I said, it varies from one end to the other.
Yeah, yeah. When you finished up here on the trainers in Alabama, what was the next step for you?
Davis-Monthan in Tucson. Mm-hmm. That's where the F4 school was. There were several of them. That was just one of them. There was also training in Homestead and training in George. That's in Victorville, California. And Davis-Monthan was another training base there. We what they call replacement training units, RTUs. Those are guys coming into the airplane for the first time, or upgrading from the back seat to the front seat, or fellows who have flown another airplane and were transitioning to it. So I got to a unit that had, in that unit, they had started something new in the Air Force. In the backseat of the F-4, it was a morale problem with all the pilots. A lot of the pilots felt trapped because they were flying as co-pilots in the back seat. They wanted to be up front. And if you had a 105 or an F-100 assignment, you got a single-seater right away. If you went to the F-4, you got a back seat assignment to start out. Some of the guys felt they didn't really want to be in that position. I think it was really not presented well to the pilots because so many of us didn't have radar experience, had no idea what intercepts were, and we were expected to learn that in the back seat. And a lot of guys just didn't understand the geometrics, the geometry of how to intercept airplanes in various roles and various positions. So the airplane was kind of above them. We all successfully completed it, obviously, but some more willingly, some more quicker at it than others.
Tell me about your introduction to the F-4 there at Davis-Monthan. Describe the F-4 for me.
Got there, of course, there's 22 student crews in the squadron. 11 of the backseaters are navigators in my class. 11 guys were pilots. I've hooked up with a guy from my hometown who had just come from the Philippines and had flown the airplane for 2 years in the Philippines in the back seat, and he was upgrading the front seat. So it kind of worked out really well. I kind of knew him going through high school, but I didn't know him well. He was, you know, 4 or 5 years ahead of me. So, but I knew who he was, and we hit it off real well. And he taught me everything he knew about the airplane. So it was a real good team effort. I enjoyed flying every hour with him because he made it fun. He made it enjoyable, and he's just a good guy. And like I said, the chemistry was there, so we enjoyed each other.
For someone who's not initiated with the F-4, tell me about this airplane. Tell me about it, its build. Tell me about its characteristics. Explain the F-4 to someone who's not familiar with it.
It's an airplane developed in the 50s by the Navy. It was to replace the Crusader, the F-8. The airplane was an air-to-air airplane, highly technically on the cutting edge of the 50s, because they felt that the gun was no longer going to be a offensive weapon. The days of visual air-to-air combat were over. Everything was going to be done by radar control, so missiles were the answer. So they equipped the airplane with two kinds of missiles, a radar-guided and a heat-seeker, and thought about the intercepts were all going to be against basically bombers, so non-maneuvering airplanes. So a gun really wouldn't be needed, and the Navy put that into the fleet arm. The Air Force, of course, had the 105, and they lost quite a few of them and needed more airplanes, and they thought about starting the production line again for the 105s, but McNamara said no, it took too long, didn't want to waste all that money to restart the line. It'd be a year before they could get new airplanes. So they said, let's look at this Navy airplane. It's got everything we want in it. It does all the things it can do. Plus, the Air Force can use it as a fighter bomber because we can put hard points on the wings and carry weapons outside. It can self-defend itself because it's got missiles. And we got two guys up there, so that means you've got good visual. One guy flying, one guy looking, and you got a radar that you can also do intercepts with. So they borrowed 4 airplanes. Guys from TAC, from Langley Air Force Base, went out with the airplanes, got checked out at Pensacola, and then flew the airplanes on various Air Force bases against other airplanes, the F-100, the 105, and pretty much signed off and said, yeah, it's capable and we can do it. And we just started getting airplanes in less than a couple of months. The St. Louis was still building them, and as long as you're still building them, you can start rolling them out the door, just start picking them for the Air Force and sending some to them and some to the Navy and some to the Marines, just keep them rolling. So McDonnell Douglas built 5,000 of them, and the Air Force probably had 1,500 of their own, and the Marines and the Navy had the rest of them. And when I went through the school, the airplanes we got were old, first generation Navy transfer type airplanes. Pretty much everything on the airplane was from the Navy, Navy technology, Navy radar, Navy design, and they painted them green and said they were trainers and go use them. So that's what we learned to fly. They were trolley models. And then once I got done with that and got qualified in the F-4, we moved to Delta models and Echo models, which are much more Air Force oriented, and the system's much more compatible to our missions. So it was a constant learning curve throughout the airplane, throughout the years going through it. And there was always new weapons being installed, the Maverick, there was laser guided bombs being installed. We self-illuminated with a laser. So that was interesting to be able to drop a bomb and capture it on a laser beam and steer it to a target. So that was another cut-through technology that was an outgrowth from the Vietnam War. The airplane itself is big. It's over 65,000 pounds. It's got about a four-hour gas load in it. With refueling, it's unlimited. It's only the crew that limits the airplane because you can refuel in the air. In the 60s, refuelings were controlled by SAC. They owned all the tankers, the TAC guys. We were begging all the time to try to get time to learn to practice aerial refueling. So we actually flew behind KC-97s, which were propeller airplanes, and that was kind of a very dismal, slow flight, very uncomfortable situation, being that slow at airspeed down around 230 knots made the airplane very sluggish. When the KC-135s came in, where they were available, we refueled around 300 knots, made the airplane much more stable, and it became very routine. In Vietnam, of course, some missions I flew as many as five refuelings, and I was airborne for over 8 hours. Across the ocean, we would do 6 to 7 refuelings and ferry the airplanes from Europe to America or downrange from America to Vietnam. And so crossing the oceans, we would not have any problems at all getting enough gas to go all the way across.
Mm-hmm. So take me through flight training with the F-4. What was the daily routine like? What were you doing academically? What were you doing flying? What was the pace of life like? Tell me about your flying there at Davis Monthan.
Okay, probably flew 3 days a week, academics 2 days a week. When I say academics, it's anything from systems, how to start the airplane, how to turn things on, how to check the radar. This airplane also had some technology advantages that systems didn't require an electronic engineer to run them. It was pretty much follow instructions, and the unit self-tested itself, self-actuated itself, so all you had to do is turn it on in the right sequence to activate the various modes. Our day started by 7 o'clock. We show up at the squadron. Pretty much if we had a briefing for a flight, 9 o'clock, 7 o'clock show, 9 o'clock takeoff. We go to the range, drop ordnance, or we go out to the air-to-air area, fly against airplanes doing intercepts. We didn't really leave the base per se. We only had 2 sorties where we actually went and landed in other bases. All the other training for almost a year was strictly out of Davis Monthan. The reasoning for that was that we are all expected to know how to navigate, and we learned that in the undergraduate pilot training. So they did not really train us to navigate. We pretty much expected that to happen. The airplane systems, they had simulators. That's part of your academics. Actually, ran the radars and some of the equipment on simulators. There were analogs, which meant that the sim people had to get up at 4 o'clock, turn them on, and get them all up to speed by 6 o'clock so they could get the stabilization of all the electronics, getting everything working correctly. So if we had a simulator sortie at 7, they were ready for us. They ran the sims till about 5 o'clock, and unless you were flying at night for night range or night activities, pretty much your duty day ended about 5. So you could figure 7 to 5 was an active day, Monday through Friday. You spent in that year flying the airplane probably 200 hours for that year. So there was 2 hours, between 2 hours and 2 hours and 30 minutes flights constantly. Sometimes you flew as much as twice a day, just depending on where you were in the timeline and what weather was doing. And there were various reasons you couldn't go to the range due to high winds sometimes. Weather sometimes came in. We did occasionally have tracks that we couldn't fly due to the weather, the buildups in the afternoon, thunderstorms and things like that. So the schedule did shift. didn't do much on the base per se, as far as our requirements for duties on the base, since we were students and our main job was to learn. We didn't have base duties. None of us pulled the alert or had to act as an aerodrome officer or act as any other capacity other than just student and learning. So that was pretty much a focused activity again, just to do that. The squadron did have some social activities, some camaraderie, some wing commander level meetings at the officers' club or the academics area, where we have mass briefings, status briefings, safety briefings, participation by various members of the organizations to brief special subjects, a situation in Europe. Tactics, political decisions made, things that we were looking at situational-wise in Southeast Asia. So it was a pretty busy day, pretty busy times, and basically we were kept active. There wasn't a lot of times off, a lot of weekends off that you had nothing to do. Even the weekends, due to the schedule, sometimes you had to fly, or other times you had academics to prepare your classes during the week.
Yeah. How did you like flying the F-4?
It was fun. Once you got over the awe of the airplane, of the monster, it was much more powerful than the T-38, bigger airplane, much more systems in it, many more things to do. And, of course, it takes time to be comfortable, and then once you get comfortable, the learning curve just jumps off the wall. When your anxiety levels are such, the noise and the vibration and all the things going on, upside down, right side up, it's hard to learn in that situation. You're so concentrated, just hanging on. But after a while, doing it 10, 15, 20 times, that environment becomes natural, and so you move right along. Like I said, the airplane was fun in the sense that it challenged your skills to think, to do math. You constantly have to calculate things, fuel flows, headings, time and distance, vectors, altitude climbs. Can you make that climb gradient to do the intercept where you want to make it within that airspace that you have available? Do you have to plan different tactics, apply different tactics? Some are canned setups where you practice them, and then you exploit that basic skill and expand it to other things. So, the airplane was such that you didn't have the comfort area of sitting back to say, I know everything this airplane will do. About that time, something new and different occurs. Mm-hmm. So you've got to be ready for the change. And you need good basic skills to identify when it does change.
Yeah. What sort of things would come up?
A generator off the line, reticle disappear off the gun sight, navigation box would decide to quit or freeze or lock up. You have to recycle it. These are primitive computers. These are analog computers. They were not like we have today, everything solid state. The computer capacity of your cell phone today is probably 10 times what we had in that airplane. That was just the state of the art that we had. We had inertial navigation systems that were just being introduced at that time. No GPS. We were still using TACAN, which is a ground-based radio signal. And so there was various component parts of the airplane that were functioning mechanically, electronically, hydraulically, that didn't always function as planned or designed. It would get your attention every once in a while. You roll into a right turn, and then we move the stick to the left, nothing happened. That's always exciting.
I'm sure.
So you find out what happened there, or some a piece of the airplane would get stuck or wouldn't function properly or only partially. Most of the stuff that we dealt with were partial interruptions and recycle them. go wings level and slow the airplane down and recycle whatever it is that you had. Like an unsaved gear light would come on because we were pulling G's. Well, that was an alignment on a safety lock switch, and it could move a little bit once you start pulling G's. In normal straight-ahead flight, it would never do that. Well, you know, if you never had it happen before and nobody ever talked about it, you go, oh, my God, what happened? The gear fell off? Well, it was just the misalignment of a safety switch. But those are the type of things that get your attention when you fly an airplane.
Yeah, I'm sure. Especially those kinds of speeds and that kind of altitude, that kind of power.
Right.
When you finish your time training on the F-4 Davis-Monthan, what's the next step for you? Where do you go next?
Half the class was immediately scheduled to depart the States and go to Vietnam. The other half the class got assigned to various wings in the States for operational experience. I went to MacDill in Florida, and other people went to Homestead, and there are other bases around. Langley had F-4s. These are wings that were active duty wings that were supporting a NATO commission commitment, and so they were preparing to support NATO operations, so they were training and kept up to speed on that, plus just general experience. With 200 hours in the airplane, you are just really a graduate student. You don't have any experience. Now you've got to deploy, now you've got to mobilize, now you've got to learn how to move airplanes and move people, have collateral duties in the squadron, intel officer, briefing officer, safety officer, maintenance officer, other jobs that keeps the squadron healthy other than just flying the airplane. So that's how you get your experience, by going to the units that are already in place. And, of course, becoming assistants initially and then eventually taking over the primary duties of, the, of those jobs. We did later on become responsible for the airfield, what they call air operations officer. You pull a 24-hour shift where you were the responding person to any cross-country flights that came in or any deviations. We also had senior officers who were what they call supervisor of flying. If the weather deteriorated, thunderstorms or other things would occur, they were responsible to make that call in place of the wing commander and the deputy of operations. They were sometimes off base, so those jobs became your primary responsibility. Of course, we're all connected with telephones. Even in those days, we had mobile telephones. And we had radios in the cars, in the various cars that we drove. So then you go out to the range, you become a range officer. So when the other guys in the squadron came out to fly, you could score their bombs and score their munitions on the range. And that was about Central Florida, called Avon Park, and you'd fly out there in a twin-engine little propeller airplane, and they drop you off of that and spend all day there and then come back that night. So you had a day on the range. Meanwhile, your buddies in the squadron were there all day long, coming in and out, doing their training that they had to do. So it was an interesting period of time for those of us that had the opportunity to do this as a brand new air crew. And like I said, half the class was upgrades. So they were coming from F-100s or going from the back seat to the front seat. They wound up getting sent almost immediately to Southeast Asia as replacements for the guys in the squadrons over there.
Why were you chosen to go to Fort McGill? Do you know why?
I had no combat experience. They needed their backseaters, of course, to fill the slots. They were moving their backseaters as they was finishing up 3 years of tours into Southeast Asia. So you had a constant rotation. Not all of them went to Southeast Asia. A lot of them went to Europe, because Europe had a rotation also. There's six F-4 bases in Europe, in Germany, and probably another three or four bases in Spain and England, which had F-4s. So there's quite a number of F-4s around in Europe. So that constantly kept that flow of people of color. Nobody spends more than 3 years, 4 years overseas. In those days, if you were unaccompanied, you left your family behind, you spent 1 year. If you were accompanied, you spent 3 years, depending on where you were, sometimes four. So there was a constant rotation back to the States.
Yeah.
Nobody wanted to stay permanently assigned overseas.
Sure. It sounds like this time at MacDill was a very beneficial one to you in terms of understanding how the operations work, how to serve as in these other capacities, as you mentioned, that are vital to the survival of the unit, to making things work, to making the missions happen. Did you feel that way?
Yes, very much so. And the year and a half at MacDill was a great transition from a student environment to an operational assignment.
Mm-hmm.
Because now you are getting experience and getting confidence in your abilities to make decisions on the fly, you were ready to start to operate as an independent unit in a combat situation. You don't have the luxury of having a supervisor watching over your shoulder when you're out in combat. You've got your skills, you've got your people around you. We normally flew two airplanes at a time, or sometimes four, and that was your fighting unit. Big mass gaggles of World War II, where you saw hundreds of airplanes, too unwieldy, really not practical to try to do that today. The firepower that you have on airplanes, an F-4 carried 12 500-pound bombs. That was the bomb load of a B-17. We had two guys in the F-4, one guy in a 105, he carried 12 bombs also, but you had 10 guys in a B-17 carrying it. They went 170 knots, we would go 450 knots. So you can see what the technology changed air combat and the way you operated.
You're still getting a lot of flying time here at MacDill?
Yeah, we're flying probably twice a week on a regular schedule. There's a simulator ride in there also. So once you get out of training, your average hours are somewhere between 15 and 20 hours a month.
Mm-hmm. Are you still keeping up with what's going on in Vietnam?
Yes, yeah.
Matter of fact, like I said...
they'd had wing level conferences and seminars, people coming down from headquarters, intel people. Sometimes we would have a Department of Defense guy come down talking various tactics, what were the latest conditions, especially since the East Coast wings were NATO committed. They wanted the air order of battle of all the Russian aircraft, the bombers, the fighters, capabilities of MiG-21, MiG-17, MiG-19, the various weapon systems on the ground that the Russian-Soviet bloc nations had. So we got briefings on that, and then almost weekly briefings on the status of what was going on in Vietnam, what was going on as far as buildups go, where assignments were being given, where things were being pulled out. There were quite a few bases in Vietnam at one time, I don't know if you remember, but Da Nang, Cameron Bay, Phu Bai, Phu Cat. Then there's three bases in Thailand, Karat, actually four, Karat, Da Nang, Thoc Le, Yuban, and Udorn were bases that all had fighter bombers there too. So there's a lot of different activities and different rules going on, different situations going on. So they would brief us on basically the operating tempos that was happening at those places.
What about the way the war is being perceived and received in the United States? Are you keeping in contact with what's going on locally in the U.S. in terms of newspapers, watching the nightly news, those sorts of things?
I think we lived off base, so you interface with civilian society. So your neighbors and people that you knew, maybe through church or various organizations or just shopping and going places and going to parties or going to social events. The conversations came up. Obviously, the war was in a lot of people's minds. Try to stay out of political discussions. You didn't really want to get yourself into the argumentative position, so we try not to be the leaders of that kind of thing. You were asked your opinion. Sometimes you gave it, sometimes you just begged off and talked around it. The best thing, really, for the guys in uniform for a war going on is it's a civilian war, and we're just doing what the civilians are asking us.
Yeah.
Not a military war. And I think that's mostly people are surprised when you have that and say, hey, we didn't start the war. You know, we're there because you guys asked us to go.
Right.
We like to stay home. I like to go fishing.
Right.
You know, if you had your choices, of course, you know, it'd be fun just flying off practice bombs, and that's all we'd ever do. But we know that that's not for real.
Sure. Did you feel that your training up to this point had adequately prepared you for going to Vietnam?
Except for the individual skills, yes. The integration of the squadrons and the tactics and the procedures of how the air war in Vietnam was conducted. The biggest problem was they turned it on and turned it off. We have these campaigns, linebacker and various incursions, and all of a sudden we had these big mass effects of going up north and we're going to knock everything out. But then you couldn't drop on the airfields. You couldn't drop in Haiphong Harbor. You couldn't drop on the power plant. You couldn't drop on the dikes. Well, what kind of war is that? I mean, what are you doing? You're putting a lot of men at stake for what kind of targets? Especially the frustration of bombing, you know, a small structure, a wooden storage building, and dropping 150 bombs on it, knowing that you've destroyed it with the first three, but the orders are you all drop on the same target, and that's where they want to see the bombs go. So, yes, sir, we'll carry out your orders. That's what you told us you want done, so we do it. But it's frustrating. And if you lose a buddy in that course, it's very disalarming and demoralizing. What was that all about? Why do we, you know, sacrifice somebody? And, of course, the Marines and the Army were doing crazy things. They spent 6, 7, 8 days trying to take a location, come up with 150, 200 casualties, and then the next day after the operation's over, they leave. They give it back. Mm-hmm. What was that all about?
Right.
So you were frustrated in that sense, and you were not prepared for that when you left the States.
Mm-hmm. The war obviously continuing to rage on here, and President Nixon says, or he takes a different approach to things, let me put it that way. What was your opinion of Nixon and the way that he was going to and was approaching the war in Vietnam?
Well, when they stopped talking and Nixon said, okay, if you don't want to talk, we'll start bombing, we were all ecstatic. We figured, finally turned the corner. We're going to do it right. We're going to go up there and kick the shit out of them and then be done with it. Well, as you know, it turned on, turned off, turned on, turned off. Every time we had these supposedly halts, Christmas time or New Year's time or whatever it was, all they did was resupply and reestablish their positions and fortify positions and made it tougher on us the next time we had to go back up there.
Mm-hmm.
So at first it was received well, very supportively, and then it kind of went on to more of the same old stuff that we've had before.
Yeah. So after your 9 months there at MacDill, is it there that you receive orders to go to Vietnam?
Yes, right.
Or Southeast Asia, I guess, in your case.
Well, yeah. I went to my first set of orders were to Karat. And along the way, I had to go to survival school for Fairchild and then jungle school in the Philippines. These are survival schools and search and escape and evasion schools. Various things were taught to survive, and then of course get to the base and then get assigned to a squadron and start the transition to start flying with those guys, get theater and indoctrinated on what call signs we use, what frequencies we use, what's our routes, where the tanker tracks are, just the general orientation of the whole air war, airspace situation. And lo and behold, during one of these bombing campaigns, Da Nang loses 4 airplanes and 2 crews. So us guys who are the unfortunate rookies, the probies, I had just gotten my check ride so that I could start flying without having to be with an IP. I had 16 missions at Karat. And they said, guess what, guys? We need some of you guys to go over to Da Nang. So here's. So there was 6 of us that got sent over to Da Nang from Karat. So I finished my tour in Da Nang. A little different war. The guys in Thailand, of course, worked a lot in Cambodia and Laos. And the guys out of Da Nang did a lot of, with the 101st Airborne, did a lot of ground suppression work up in the northern part of the country in the DMZ area. So it was a different theater of geographic location. But basically, you're just moving parts of the puzzle from one side of the board to the other. So, Tak Lee,
let me.
Rot was in Thailand. Da Nang was right by the sea in the northern part of Vietnam. Much higher threat levels. Rocket City was Da Nang. The Viet Cong would have a lot of, they didn't call them suicide bombers in those days, but satchel guys would throw a satchel in the back of a pickup truck and blow it up, or into a bus, or leave a bomb at a bus stop type thing. In Thailand, I never saw any of that. They were much more secure. You went downtown, you ate in restaurants, and you traveled on the Thai transportation system. In Vietnam, we pretty much stayed only at the compounds, either the Army compound or the Air Force compound. And we didn't do a lot of traveling around the local communities.
Let me interrupt you here, Mr. Chismadia, and go back just a little bit. You mentioned that you received your orders for Vietnam while you were there at MacDill, and then you mentioned survival school. Could you take me through your survival school here in the States? What did that consist of?
Before you go to combat, like I told you, we went through the airplane and actually operating the equipment. Well, as with any combat operation, there's going to be times when you're going to put yourself in harm's way. And if you have to jump out of that airplane, you have to parachute eject out of that airplane, you may not be in good guy country. And if you're on the ground, well, of course, you've got to know how to handle yourself, separate yourself from the enemy, avoid capture, and hopefully get recovered so that you can make it back to home. If you're on the ground, it's called escape and evasion. If you're in the water, of course, it's survival in the water. And if you're in the jungle, it's escape and evasion with jungle problems, which is different than just surviving the parachute fall and the ground. And the jungle is very unforgiving. You know that diseases are rampant. A small cut or scratch can turn into infection within hours. There's certain critters out there that eat you, such as jaguars, snakes, anacondas. These are things that you don't really think about when you're sitting at your home in Davis Mountain in Tucson, Arizona, or up at Norfolk in Langley Air Force Base in Virginia. So you have to kind of acclimate yourself to that condition. So along the way, they send you to school. I went to water survival school at Homestead, learned how to use rafts, learned how to use flotation devices, how to minimize environmental impacts, sun, wind, rain, cold in the water environment. And then, of course, the Escape and Evasion School was taught up in Fairchild in Washington. That was to prepare you for possible capture, POW camp, interrogation. We knew that if the Viet Cong got us, it wasn't going to be a good day. The North Vietnamese took upon themselves this position of higher authority, so once they got you, they completely controlled you mentally, physically, beat on you, browbeat you, really treated you as a second-class type critter, not even a human. And so we had to be prepared for that. All the guys who were going to be possibly on the ground in a hostile environment went through that kind of training. And that included the Navy and the Army guys, chopper pilots, and the Air Force, of course.
I wonder if you might take me through some of this training in specific detail. Say, up there in Washington, the Escape and Evasion School there. How was it set up? What types of classes are you taking? What is the physical environment like? You talked about preparation to become a POW and interrogations and beatings and things like that. Can you take me through your time there at the Survival Evasion School? Before we experienced that technical difficulty, Mr. Chismay, you were talking about the Survival Evasion Escape School. I wonder if you might take me through your time up there in Washington. How was the school set up, both in terms of classes, the physical environment, the POW preparation, those kinds of things? Take me through that.
You kind of got me walking a thin line here. A lot of that's still classified.
Okay. Well, is there anything that you can talk about?
We did it. We were prepared. Pretty much everybody who went to Southeast Asia in a capacity where they might be on the ground behind enemy lines got it. The specifics, when we went through it, they were all secret, top secret, so we really didn't have a debriefing on could we talk about it later on and how long a period of time. I don't think it's changed that much, so we're kind of talking about things that we really don't really want to make public knowledge.
Okay, that's fine. That's no problem at all.
Basis.
No, that's no problem. No problem at all. You mentioned that obviously you joined the Air Force because you wanted to fly, but also because you wanted to serve. You know that you're going to Vietnam. What are your thoughts on this at the time, and what were your family's thoughts on your going to Vietnam? A very controversial time, very controversial conflict, obviously.
Well, of course, my mom and dad were both immigrants, had grown up in Europe, and they were born actually here. My grandparents had traveled to America and spent some time here with relatives, and my mom was born here, my dad was born here, and then went back to Europe, and then at age 21, they had to declare their citizenship, either they were going to be Americans or Hungarians. And both of them decided independently, they didn't know each other then, to become immigrants and come here to America. So their thought was, well, it's our country. European ethic is that your birthland is important. And if your country asks you to fight your birthland, it's your duty to do that. So I think a lot of that came across culturally to America by the Europeans. So they embraced service to their country and passed it on to us. That was our duty to do that if so chosen to happen. I happened to want to fly airplanes because my dad could understand that, being a machinist and working with machines and mechanical things. My mom didn't understand it at all. She just thought it was silly to have to go up in the air and race around and do all those kind of things. But if I was happy doing it, well, so be it, and she was there to help. That's what I really wanted to do. So as I got to high school and college, she saw I was serious enough to pursue that, so she was supportive. Probably regretfully in some ways, but again, she didn't stop me from doing it. She wasn't vehemently opposed. So myself, especially after the training, after the preparation, after going through college and the prepping of the undergraduate training and then the graduate training, checking out, you've reached a certain level of skills that you want to say, hey, I am one of those. Well, how do you know? If you don't go out and practice it in a real world, how do you know if you got the skills or the materials or the fortitude to do the job? The only way you know that is to be tested. And, of course, combat does test you. And serving your country in a combat situation is definitely a testing situation. And if you pass the test by living through it, you're a better person. So I kind of say I kind of won. I did the right things. And I'm not sad I did them. Some places I wouldn't want to do them again. But if the country calls me and says, hey, your skills are such that, you know, we want you to do this, that's my duty. I would do it again.
Right. Okay, you had all of this training in the F-4. You're a pilot. You receive your orders from Vietnam. The war is what it is. Take me through the process for you to get to Vietnam. When do you leave? How do you get there?
As the rotations come up, as guys are coming back. Now, I remember half my class went right away. Well, this is a year and a half later. Those guys are coming home. So we're here in the States, haven't been there yet, so we're getting chosen to go over there. And so they pick our names and they assign us to various bases, and off we go by military airlift. We have to meet an airplane in a certain place, and they transport us to Travis. And Travis then has an aircraft, either military aircraft or charter aircraft, that fly us into, my case, they flew us to the Philippines. Because my first stop was jungle school, survival school.
How did that survival school differ from the previous survival schools?
Environmental. Of course, you found... Now you had a Pacific Rim environment. The one in Washington is pretty much a general, could be Europe, it could be Africa, it could be, you know, Latin America. The one in the Philippines is pretty much oriented to Southeast Asia, Vietnam, Thailand environment. So geographically, culturally, you were indoctrinated in that type of environment. That's where you're going to live for the next year. So that's what they prepared you for. Like I said, the jungle is very unforgiving. If you injure yourself, if you get into certain critters, you don't get a second chance. They got a bamboo viper they call two-step. If you're hit, if it bites you, you have about two steps, and that's how fast it works. The neurotoxin is that powerful. So obviously you have to avoid that. You're not going to get a second chance. So that's how it changes. That's the reason that it's a different school. It's taught by different instructors. And again, how to use your equipment, what equipment you're going to have, what are you going to use to communicate with, how are you going to communicate. One thing to survive is to be found. Well, if you're in a combat situation and the bad guys are looking for you, being found is not good. So now you got to hide. So that's a different whole concept of moving around or doing what you're doing in an environment. So you've got to learn how to do that.
Can you offer any specifics on that? How is it different in not just the geography and, like you say, the critters and things like that? But what was jungle survival specifically about?
Well, using the foliage. If you want to get captured in the jungle, all you got to do is run. The birds and the various animals will screech, holler, warn the others. If you want to be hidden, all you have to do is sit down, find yourself a big leaf, and don't move. And you blend right in. So that's one of the things where it's a different thinking cycle. You know, of what you got to do. How do you find water in the jungle? Well, you would think that you'd have puddles and ponds of water. Well, you might, but then what are they infested with?
Mm-hmm.
What kind of bacteria are in that water? What kind of insects are in that water? You find out the sources of water sometimes are vines. Sometimes the leaves themselves are captured like cups. You can find water from the rain just sitting on a leaf. Just by pushing the leaf down, you've got a couple of mouthfuls of water. So it's a different approach to what your survival part is. And, of course, they're going to talk to you about interrogation. They're going to talk to you about sleep deprivation, some of the other things that we found that was common to everybody. Some of the how to move about without falling into traps, without falling into booby traps, things that look like they should be there, something out of the ordinary in the jungle could tip you off if somebody was there ahead of you, and maybe they have a reception for you that you don't want to see, like punji sticks or drop a log across the trail and crush you, things like that that you would not be aware of or even thinking about walking around in your normal airbase environment.
And how long did this last?
2 weeks.
2 weeks. Okay, so you finished up your survival training there in the Philippines. Where's the next stop for you?
Down to base ops, C-130, and they had transports going to all the various bases in country,
mm-hmm.
both Vietnam and Thailand, and they route you through the airplane that's going to do a circuit. Maybe it's going to stop six different places today. So you ride the taxi.
And where do you come into Vietnam?
At that time, I went right to Bangkok.
Okay.
And Bangkok, they had buses drive us up to Korat.
Describe for me your first impressions of Southeast Asia, coming to Bangkok and then to Korat. What are your impressions of these places?
Well, Bangkok, as soon as they opened the door, it was like walking into a steamy, rotten food plant. The environment there is such that the humidity is 95%. It's the worst, hottest, muggiest day that you'd ever think about in the swamps of Louisiana or Georgia. And, of course, you got flies and you've got all kinds of critters flying around, and the smells, the sounds are totally different than anything we've had here. The people speaking their language does not sound like anything we've heard here. So it's very much a step back and say, I guess I'm not in Iowa anymore, Toto.
Right.
I'm in a different part of the universe.
And how do you adjust to that?
You just grab your bag and move along. And, you know, you got your orders. You know you need to get to Korat. Talk to the fellows who greet you at the airplane. And they've been through this 100 times before, so they route you over to either billeting for the night or down to the terminal where the buses are, and you get on transportation, and you're on your way.
Take me through the process by which you get to your unit. What is your unit when you arrive?
Well, it's a bus ride for about 3 hours up to Korat. And once you arrive at the main gate, they take you over to, again, the passenger terminal. Your whatever bags you have with you, you walk inside and they say, okay, you've got an inbound or an in-brief tomorrow morning at 9 o'clock. Go to the BOQ right now today, find a room for the night, give you a map of the base so you can find around where you're going to be. Sometimes they have a base bus that does a tour, so it stops at various places along the way. Other places they ask the billeting people to come down and pick you up, and they'll take you over to billeting. Usually the bases are small enough that you can walk to most areas. If you're going into a flight line, of course, you'll probably wind up in a pickup truck converted to a kind of an open bus. where they drop the tailgate and they put a couple of bench seats along the sides and a canopy on top to keep the rain off of you. And that's what we call crew buses. And they drive us around out to our airplanes and pick us up when we come in. And, so you're now at the BOQ, across the street's the O Club. Probably get out of your travel clothes, whatever you're in. In my case, it's probably a flight suit. Sometimes you wear khakis, depending on what the rules are at the base that you're on. But anyhow, you change out of that, get into a short sleeve, shorts, moccasins or sandals, get comfortable, because you're sweating and you're very uncomfortable because you're not used to that environment. So it's an uncomfortable couple of weeks to get used to that humidity. Over the club, usually by around 3:30, 4 o'clock, the club gets to the center of the social event for the day. Everybody's coming off the flying schedule, and everybody's wrapping up their day's work, the normal day, so they're all down for some sort of refreshment, adult beverage, and then we'll have a couple of steaks maybe, or whatever the club officer has. The clubs, we're really driven by the membership of the wing commander's thoughts. Some clubs were really nice, had good kitchens, well-stocked. Other clubs were just functional. So it varied from base to base. Didn't have a uniformity. There's a swimming pool next to the club, usually because the days are in the 80s and 90s, and the humidity is 95%. The pool is probably pretty popular. There are no women, or very few women. So it's all guys, like a big fraternity.
Mm-hmm.
And the next morning, you go to the in-brief at the wing headquarters, give them your orders, and then they assign you a squadron.
And what squadron were you assigned to?
34th at the Karat.
Okay.
34th TIE Fighter Squadron.
Okay, well, I think that probably brings us to a good place to stop for today, Mr. Chizmadian.
Okay.
This is Kelly Krager continuing an oral history interview with Mr. Joseph Chizmadian. Today is 5 May 2014. I'm in Lubbock, Texas, on the campus of Texas Tech University. And Mr. Chizmadian is joining me by telephone from Port Orchard, Washington. Mr. Chizmadian, when we left off last time, you were describing coming into country there in Thailand. And I wonder if you might pick up the narrative there, please.
All right, sir. We had just departed Jungle Survival School in Clark Air Force Base in the Philippines, flew a C-130 into Bangkok, and then we're taking a bus ride up to Karat, that's northwest of Bangkok in the western part of the of Thailand. The squadron there is a 34th TAC fighter squadron composed of F-4E models, and they're primary mission is the air-to-ground mission in the Southeast Asia theater.
Mm-hmm. Now, are you immediately assigned, or do you have, or to a plane, do you have other duties that you have to take care of once you get in country, orienting yourself on what's going on, the lay of the land, etc.?
Once you get the in-brief, get assigned quarters, you're pretty much academic start with rules of engagement, the orientation of the battle plan, the friendlies, the ground forces, overall operations of both South and North Vietnam. Then we fly with an IP, the first four or five rides for an aircraft checkout in the theater, followed by a check ride with a qualified flight lead who takes us up. And we perform the functions of a wingman, and that'll both be as a non-refueling and refueling day-night evolution, so that we can go just about anywhere in Southeast Asia, from North Vietnam all the way down to the Mekong Delta.
Mm-hmm. Now, when you roll into your new unit, who are the people there? How was it set up, the command structure? the pace of life, the pace of missions, etc.?
Each squadron, there was two F-4 squadrons, a 105 squadron at Karat. The two F-4 squadrons are primarily air-to-ground ordnance, delivering close air support and interdiction. They flew one squadron, flew a month at night. Then they rotated with the other squadron. The other squadron flew a month at night. Obviously, the squadron that wasn't flying at night flew in the daytime. So it kept the rotation 24/7 pretty much as far as the commitments to aircraft. Each squadron had 18 airplanes assigned and about 22 air crews to fly those airplanes.
Mm-hmm. How long is it before you go out on your first mission on your own?
3 days.
3 days, so they put you in pretty quick. Yeah.
And then flew a, what we call a kind of dollar ride, low threat, pretty much area orientation, maybe a strike package put together of four airplanes, and there'd be high altitude bombing. We'd probably have a little tour around northern Thailand, along the border with Vietnam, coming down through Laos and Cambodia, and then back home.
How would you go out on a mission? Take me through the process once you arrive, from the briefing to you know, pre-flight to all the things you need to do. Take me on a typical mission.
Okay, we first get assigned the mission the day before. Collateral duties with flying the airplane is also scheduling, training, life support, tactics. Those are all jobs that are assigned to the various members of the unit. They specialize in that area, and then they'll brief us accordingly on the subjects, depending on where we're going. We have what they call a frag, and that's part of the air tasking order for the day. All the units throughout Southeast Asia that were assigned to support Vietnam were given tasks for each day from 7th headquarters. They were broken down to each of the wings. The wings then broke those down to each of the squadrons. The squadrons then broke it down to each of the air crews. So you were assigned the day before. You went into crew rest depending on what time you had to report to work. A typical day started around 6 o'clock a.m. By 7, you were in a mass brief, overall mission brief. At 8 o'clock, you broke out to individual flight briefs, and by 9 o'clock, you were airborne. So the day started fairly early. Flew for 2 to 3 hours, came back, put the airplanes on the ground. Maintenance got a hold of them, fueled them, reloaded them, and then the afternoon sorties would be generated and flown for their assignments. So the typical day started around 6, ended about 2, and then, of course, if you flew the afternoon schedule, your day started around 12, and again ended at probably about 8 o'clock at night.
Mm-hmm. Were you ever called upon to fly both, the morning and afternoon?
A double blast would be rare, just due to the length of time it took to get debriefed and briefed. Your overlaps... So it occasionally happened, but not very often. And usually it was because an unexpected crew absence or somebody got sick and you needed to fill in for somebody like that.
Mm-hmm. Sure. What kind of targets would you be looking for, or what type of targets would be assigned to you? Are you going to work with troops in contact? Are you interdiction missions? What types of missions are you primarily flying?
Most of the work that we did is along the trail, along the river, coming out of North Vietnam, coming down south along the Laotian border. That was the trail. That was the interdiction route for most of the supplies coming down. The Thailand airplanes mostly worked the western side of Vietnam. Da Nang, Phu Cat, Ben Hoa, Cameron Bay worked in country. They were pretty much working with the army in each of their geographic locations. So you would have a western force coming up out of Thailand, and eastern force working the in-country Vietnam. both sides would go north when so directed. When we did do north strikes, so the packages would assemble over South Vietnam and then move north as a big group, sometimes as many as 36 to 48 airplanes going up north.
And what sort of targets would you be looking for over North Vietnam?
North Vietnam was the steel plants, the rail yards, the rail tracks coming out of China, working truck parks, storage areas, SAM sites, and some occasional AAA sites along the coastal of, plains of North Vietnam, where they would both have guns for offshore shore to ship fire, and they would also fire AAA up against the aircraft.
I wonder if you might take me on one of these flights in terms of where you're going, what the targets are, how the unit is working, the bombing. For someone who is completely uninitiated with this, take me through this step by step, as much detail as you can remember.
Okay, guys coming out of Thailand normally hit a tanker due to the distance and time that they had to fly. So we go to a tank first, get fuel. While on the tanker, we'd get assignments to a FAC who would be already in the area and would have already had some intel on where troops might be or supplies might be, or if he's working with an Army unit, where an Army unit might be in contact with hostiles. So then we go from the tank down to the FAC area. Check in with the FAC. He gives us the target description. We tell him what ordnance we have on board, and then he directs us to proceed on restricted headings. Usually, as long as flying over the friendlies, depending on the terrain, you want to make sure you have enough terrain clearance when you're pulling off the target. So he's in charge of that area, of that airstrike. We did not drop South Vietnam ordnance without a FAC approval. In North Vietnam, we had pre-planned targets. There was no FAC. We went to a certain point and delivered our munitions, our weapons on that kind of structure, that kind of infrastructure that was already pre-assigned and pre-selected. The tank going home, since we're light now and we don't have the ordnance on us, very often no post-strike fuel. We directly go back expeditiously to the home plate. Our North Vietnam, we would hit a tanker going up north, and we hit a tanker coming back south, coming back down to our base.
You've mentioned a couple of times hitting the tanker and getting fuel. This is airborne, obviously. For someone who is not aware of how this would work, how would you refuel midair at those speeds?
The airplanes are all equipped with a refueling door on top of the airplane. We would manually open that door, fly formation behind a KC-135 tanker. The boom operator then would put the boom into the refueling door and pump us with 6,000 to 7,000 pounds of fuel, top us off, and then we drop off the tankers and go to the target. On the way home, of course, we take maybe 3,000 pounds and then head home with that fuel. The tankers are all pre-assigned daily. They were just like a resupply ship coming to port. They go to a certain geographic position at a certain altitude, and they would spend their time there until they offloaded the required amount of fuel for that evolution. They were then relieved with another tanker coming in behind them. And their station time is about 4 hours. So we'd hit the same tank going and coming, and then in the afternoon there'd be a different aircraft in the same location for the afternoon guys.
About how long would it take to get this, say, 6,000 pounds of fuel?
They pump us about 1,000 pounds a minute, so 6 minutes on the boom. Pretty fast.
Yeah.
Airplanes are built originally, to pump enough fuel to top off the B-52s on their missions going into the Soviet Union. So they had to have a pretty high fuel rate because a 52 with eight engines is burning a lot of gas. So they would have to pump it in pretty fast because they were burning it.
Yeah.
It didn't quite take that long with us. We're a lot smaller, and our offloads went much quicker. B-52 on the boom, 15, 20 minutes is not unusual.
Yeah.
For us, that would be a really long time.
Yeah. Tell me what type of ordnance you would typically have on your aircraft. And I would assume it would change for missions depending on what you'd be doing.
Again, coming down to the frag from 7th Air Force, they would decide what munitions people had on their aircraft depending on where that aircraft left from, and occasionally we would have specialized ordnance, such as troops in contact. We would have a 500-pound bomb with a high-drag device, which means that the bomb doesn't glide very well. It comes off the airplane almost instantaneously, drops straight underneath it, and then you also have napalm, which we didn't normally carry if we went up north against hard targets. So if you're going close air support, that was one load. If you're going for interdiction in truck parks, then we were looking at the general purpose 500-pound bombs. Each aircraft carried 12, and we made passes individually, dropping three or four at a time. So in three passes, we would drop all the bombs. The napalm was four cans, so we would drop two at a time for that.
Mm-hmm. I wonder if you might take me through a troops in contact mission. Do any of these stand out to you?
Fire support base suppression. We did have attacks on the fire support bases because they were supporting the troops in the field. And if there was any hostiles in North Vietnamese or Viet Cong, the ground forces would call the artillery in to pepper their area. So that was a high sort after target. They would have troops coming in out of the jungle, attacking the perimeters of these bases, trying to destroy the guns. When that happened, the Army immediately would call helicopters because they can work very close, they can work low. Their immediate response, they're usually pretty close to where these fire support bases are. If it was a big fight, a large engagement, they'd call in TAC Air, and we would drop under the guidance of a FAC. He would be talking to the guys on the ground, and whoever the artillery commander was would give him directions on where he wants ordnance.
Mm-hmm. Are there any particular missions that stand out to you?
Probably Fire Support Base Fuller. That was in 72 that we had that occasion, and it comes to mind because we were told to destroy the installation, which is not usually what you want to do to your friendlies, but
yeah.
The base was declared indefensible. The ground commander evacuated his men out in one direction and asked us to work from the opposite side of the camp, across the camp, and once they were clear, we were clear to engage the camp from one end to the other, leaving nothing behind for the enemy to use.
Mm-hmm. Was the were there enemy present there at the fire support base at this time?
Oh yes, yes, they were in the water. There was hand-to-hand combat. The ground commander was essentially overrun. They managed to get to a command post area, managed to fight off until we dropped some close support ordnance on them. They were then able to get out the back while we finished the job on the other end of the camp.
Mm-hmm. And just completely destroyed the fire base there.
Yeah, when we were done, there was nothing but a pit. Mm-hmm. It was essentially a dirt-moving pit is all that was left.
When you get back from these missions, or do you have someone who's reporting to you a bomb damage assessment of how accurate you were?
As we were leaving the target area, the FAC would normally go down, do a visual survey, and give us what was it called, BDA, bond damage assessor. Tell us how many trucks maybe or how many KIA there was. There was a time period where our successes were measured by what they call body count. If you remember, General Westmoreland was big into pushing numbers of troops destroyed, troops killed, whereas to us, it was bombs on target were really most important. Bomb effect was something we didn't have that much control over. It just depended on who picked the ordnance and what we had. But, yeah, they'd give us that. We write it down, bring it back to the intel folks at the base. They would put it in the system, and then we would brief in the next morning the results of the operation of the previous day. So they compiled all the missions from just not us, but all the bases, all the areas, gave us pretty much a situation, what was going on, progress made or not made.
So you come back in from a mission, whether it's an interdiction mission or a troops in contact. You come back in, land the plane. What do you do next?
Well, if there's any maintenance issues, of course, report to maintenance, give them the status of the airplane. We would go inside, unwind a little bit, maybe 10 minutes of getting out of your flight gear and getting something to drink, something to snack on. Then go down to intel and briefly describe what you did throughout the mission, chronological order of activities, any new things or unexpected things that we weren't briefed on, threat analysis, new gun positions, AAA response, maybe truck park area that we didn't know about, things like that, so that intel could make a plan for the next day.
What kind of enemy fire did you encounter most regularly, or just tell me about the enemy fire in general? What were you receiving fire from? How effective were they, et cetera?
Well, it seemed like everybody in the country carried an AK-47, and they shot at us whenever we were in their area. So there was a lot of small arms fire. And the Viet Cong used just about every kind of weapon that was on the earth in the 1970s, from French rifles, British rifles, American captured weapons. They had everything in the world. Probably the most dangerous to us was the Stinger missile that they started to carry, and it gave them a big advantage over just gunfire. The Stinger missile was a heat seeker, and when we pulled off the target, these handheld shoulder-mounted weapons could be fired at us and track the heat signature of the engines. They did also have fixed guns and portable guns. 23 millimeter were twin barrels and quad barrels. They were on a trailer that could be hauled behind an oxen or a jeep or a truck. They had 37s and 57s. These are higher altitude, bigger shells. They fired those at us in route while we were flying across the landscape. Pretty much engaged enemy on the surface would be a small arms fire, which was the reason we dropped a lot of the ordnance above 4,000 feet to keep us out of the small arms. And then heavy weapons, they had some guns that were radar controlled, and of course SAMs. When we were at 20,000 feet, they could knock us out of the sky using SA-2s, SAM missiles, and these are all radar controlled missiles made by the Soviets and given to the North Vietnam people to use.
What would you do, say there's a SAM or a Stinger that's locked onto you? How do you deal with that?
Well, maneuverability was a big factor, depending on how much ordnance you had left and how heavy you were and what the terrain was like. Usually, random pull-offs, not predictable flight patterns were really big, not letting them really track you well. And if you had two airplanes working a target, there's always an airplane pointed at the target coming down into a delivery pass where the other guy was pulling off. So they never had any time to really settle down and stand up and aim their weapons. It was all quick snapshots. If you could keep that happening, your survival rate was much higher. Also, the situation was if you tried not to drop ordnance into the area immediately where they were, but work the ordnance to them so that they were constantly having to keep their heads down and not being able to take time to aim and load and do all those things that are necessary for a ground ordnance.
Mm-hmm. Now, were you yourself ever shot?
I only had one damage spot on the airplane. It was a fluke. It was just a brace that carried some of the weapon station material. It looked like they hit me with a 12.7, which is essentially a 50 caliber bullet off a machine gun, but it didn't do any really, it was just a peripheral damage. It didn't affect the flying characteristics of the airplane. So.
Yeah.
Luckily, I did the right things at the right time, and the Golden BB wasn't out there.
Yeah, I guess so. You come back in from his flights, like you say, you debrief, you report any maintenance issues, and you just kind of try to chill out a little bit, maybe have a beer, grab a sandwich or something like that. What other things can you tell me about base life when you're there? Are you writing letters home? Do you do the reel-to-reel recorders? You know, what newspapers or magazines are you reading, music you're listening to? What goes on there when you're not?
Well, I guess in those days it was reel-to-reel tapes. Everybody was looking at the base exchange catalogs because our base exchanges were nothing but real quick 7-Eleven type stores. So everything was in a catalog. Of course, those that were in Thailand for a length of time got a chance to get down to Bangkok, well, a major city, so you could shop there. Some guys had tailor shops, clothing, custom-made shirts, suits, shoes. So you found things to occupy your time. Writing a letter a day home was pretty much standard procedure. Letting the loved ones know that you're still all right, and, life was going on. And, of course, looking for the mail call, the other side of that, coming home with care packages, things that weren't easily gotten in country. Some of the specialized things people have is they have a favorite cologne or a toothpaste or something you couldn't get on the local economy there in that part of the world. So, of course, your family would send you care packages at that time. And, of course, those that were married with children, keeping some kind of contact with their families, drawings and just little messages and endearments that came from their loved ones. It was kind of important. Quiet time was usually at the end of the day, after dinner, a couple hours, just kind of maybe playing some cards or writing a letter home or listening to your stereo reel-to-reel player. And we didn't have DVDs in those days or CDs. Everything was on tape. And they were just bringing in the cassettes at that time, so a lot of guys were playing with their cassette machines and getting cassettes made up. We got, everybody was so into the cassette that a lot of us carried a cassette portable recorder with us on missions, and they became standard equipment for debriefs because we could record the cockpit conversations during the flight, giving us a good remembrance of what occurred and what the sequence was of events, where before we were trying to do it by memory.
What about news? Are you reading newspapers? Is it just Stars and Stripes? How are you keeping up with events?
Armed Forces Radio, TV, black and white, and a lot of canned old committee and series, things like that. Occasionally they would have sports replays of the World Series or playoff games. And Stars and Stripes are the only paper that you really got in the field. There was papers in against Saigon and Bangkok, but being out in the field and away from those places, we didn't have access to a daily publication. So most of our news came through the Armed Forces system.
What about music? We oftentimes think of the Vietnam War, and one of the things that always seems to pop up is the music of the age, of the era. What kind of music did you listen to there?
Creedence was probably very popular. Peter, Paul, and Mary, the folk songs of the 70s, everybody had cassettes of those. The rock and roll era was pretty strong, so it was a lot of rock and roll music, and it was fairly eclectic of everything from hard rock all the way to classical, but depending on the individual's taste. Mostly, like I said, the music originally started on reel to reel and then went to cassettes from that. So they would record their own. After a while, the BX did start carrying pre-recorded tapes. And then downtown, these little shops, there must have been a gazillion tapes that were available that were counterfeit. And though they discouraged them from buying them, they were like 25 cents a piece. So there's a lot of that going on. The guys who buy counterfeits and have copies of them.
You mentioned the local population selling these things. What kind of contact did you have with the local ties?
Along the base gates, there would be little shops where they had the porcelain elephants, the brass candlesticks, all kinds of wooden things made by the ties, and salad bowls, and anything that would catch an eye to a tourist that they were there. And of course, they had these little like pop-up tents that they made out of packing material and called them their stores, their shops. And of course, jewelry. Guys actually went and had jewelry made, custom jewelry made, both gold and silver. So there were things to occupy yourself if you got out and about.
Mm-hmm. Were there any sort of service facilities there in terms of, recreation things? I think you mentioned a swimming pool before, or library, anything like that?
Swimming pool, yes. At the club, there was a pool, and a typical setup would be a pool bar and a snack bar, with probably a pool 25 meters by 15 meters was an average size pool, so you could do laps. There was a golf range, golf courses. I remember at Talk Lee. I don't remember one at Karat, because Talk Lee had a Thai Air Force wing. They supported the base much more directly to the levels of recreation and housing and that type of thing. There was tennis courts, there were basketball courts, handball courts, trying to think what else did we see over there that kind of mostly individual sports. Occasionally there was a league of softball. Being that it was so hot and muggy, softball really was kind of tough to play. And at night, the mosquitoes and the flies and everything else ate your lives. So outdoor recreation in that sense, we didn't do that. There wasn't any football. I guess the commanders discouraged that from the injury standpoint, guys whacking each other. But individual sports, individual recreation, things like that, probably pretty popular.
Yeah.
I remember playing handball, playing tennis, and they were a recreational facility there where they, rented or lent out the equipment that you needed to play. Volleyball, we played quite a bit of volleyball.
Mm-hmm. Now, while we're on the topic here of off time, were you able to take an R&R leave?
Yes, 6 months into your tour, everybody was given a week off, and a lot of guys went back to Hawaii, met their wives, had a second honeymoon in Hawaii. Some single guys went down to Australia. Hong Kong, and took the sights in that part of the world. I was married, so I went back to Honolulu and spent a weekend in Honolulu for my R&R.
Mm-hmm. Well, what can you tell me about that R&R in Hawaii? I mean, the war is winding down from the American standpoint. It's still not terribly popular, obviously. And to leave the war zone to go back to the States, to Hawaii to meet your wife, what was that like there? What was the environment like in Honolulu?
Well, we flew again. We had orders, and so we flew a military airlift back to Honolulu, checked in at a government hotel, Fort DeRussy, which is an Army post, set up a rental hotel where everybody had very nice accommodations and a very inexpensive rate, like $20 a night, as opposed to, in those days, Honolulu probably ran anywhere from $75 to $150 a night, normal economy. So it gave us quite a bit break in the finances to afford the stay. And of course, all the accoutrements of a resort were in Honolulu, from sailboating to powerboating, diving, you name it, anything you wanted to do there. As far as interfacing with the local population in Hawaii, didn't seem to have a big animosity towards the war, due to the fact the economy was just booming due to all the GIs coming through and spending their time there and spending their money. So coming back to the States, some of the fellows felt kind of put out upon. Well, if you had the long-haired hippies and you came back from a war zone, you were pretty much short, hair-cutted, and you could tell definitely that you were not the local habitat, and you were definitely coming back out of another situation. So basically, we stayed to ourselves, try to stay out of the limelight, enjoy our families closely there, and just not, you know, look for any kind of problems, any kind of conflict.
Yeah. Now, you get back, say, from Hawaii. Was it difficult to go back to the war zone after you'd been away?
Oh, yeah. Nobody was looking for that return flight. We were hoping engines would fall off and wings would collapse. Anything to keep us, you know, there any longer period of time was wonderful. But, of course, the reality was that, you know, if you got back to work, you got back, the next 6 months would go by pretty fast, and, you know, you'd be heading home. So reality says that you have to go, like it or not. But it was begrudging. It was not a great event in your life to have to go back to what you just turned your back on a week ago.
Yeah, and I would assume it'd be difficult for your wife as well.
Yeah.
Now, you're involved in a couple of important air campaigns here. I believe it was a commando hunt and a linebacker.
Yes.
Would you mind tell me about those?
Linebacker was reopening the bombing up north. I guess when the peace talks broke down, Nixon brought that card out of the pack and said, okay, guys, you're not going to talk to us, then we're going to bomb you. I think we, the Navy mined Haiphong Harbor, denied the ship's entry into the northern part of North Vietnam, so we kept the supply line down, pretty much interdicted the railroads, and knocked out the power plants. So they lost a lot of their infrastructure support. Various ingenious people that they were, they took nothing and made do with what they had. And so the more we seen the bomb them, the more resolve they had to not give up. Finally, the South, I guess, ran out of some supplies, so they pulled the effectiveness of the AAA out because they didn't have the ammunition. I know SAMs, at one point they said they'd fired off all their available SAMs, so the AAA from the SAM threat was very greatly diminished. But every time we had a bombing halt, every time we had a reprieve, they seemed like little ants. They would just get it all redone in two or three days, it seemed like they've recovered everything. It took weeks and months to blow apart. These guys had it all back together again. So a constant battle. It was a constant your mind over my mind battle. But I'd say that the linebacker, they definitely were reeling. They were not progressing in any direction. I think we were stalemated at that point.
What is the pace of life like for you during, say, linebacker? Are you still just one mission a day? Are you flying up more?
Linebacker missions went up north and took 3.5-4 hours. You couldn't turn the airplanes very well. You could have a day night, but not two turns of the day. It took too long to reconstitute the second force, the second go. Then of course the planes needed maintenance. Every time you flew them all day long, that night they were pretty much out of commission. You had radar to fix or weapons released to fix or an engine that was run out of time or whatever. So these surges could only be done for limited amount of time. You couldn't keep the pace up for months at a time. It would only be a couple of weeks, and then you'd have to kind of slow it back down, catch it all back up again. I can't ever say we ran out of parts, but I know that it took time to get a lot of this stuff done, and maintenance certainly worked the clock 7 days a week around the clock to keep the airplanes going.
How would you rate the effectiveness of the maintenance?
Probably the best that I've ever seen. The guys were doing a super job. I didn't ever have an airplane that I was scared to fly because it was ready to fall apart. Some of them weren't new. I mean, there were patches on some of these things. They had 1945, 1947 DC-3s, C-47s that they used. They had Korean vintage bombers, B-26s. They used along the trail. They had airplanes that the Navy used. The Sky Raiders were Korea vintage. So they were older airplanes, but they seemed to have weathered well, and the guys did a super job in keeping them airworthy. Mm-hmm.
So you spent a little bit of time, at Korat, and then I guess the most of your time was spent in or flying out of Da Nang. Is that correct?
Yeah, 6 weeks at Korat, and then the rest of the year at Da Nang, about 10 months.
Yeah, and pretty busy pace of life there, it sounds like.
Yeah, I mean, that again is dependent on you and your incentives. Some guys kind of hit out. They got more involved in their collateral duties than flying the airplanes, and other guys flew the airplanes every day, and that way you kept busy, you were on a schedule, you were pretty much routine. And time went by, until your day was gone before you knew it. Like I said, you started 6 o'clock in the morning. By 3 o'clock in the afternoon, it was time to relax and done.
Right.
And those 9 hours flying and working, or you could spend them sitting and looking out the window. I chose to be busy. I figured every hour I was working was 1 hour less that I had to think about what was going on or why was I there, and get into a mental state. So by doing your job and staying focused on that, I think it made you keep your sanity.
Yeah. Now, was Da Nang still being hit pretty regularly by rocket attacks?
About once a week. We would get mostly kind of just an annoying type activity just to keep disrupting you. Hardly any time during the day. It was almost always at night, and they were randomly selecting parts of the base. They were not hitting any one space. It was just wherever these rockets would fall in the general area. Harassment more than anything else, just to keep you on your toes.
Mm-hmm. Now you stay in, I guess, Da Nang till about what, May or so of 1972.
Yeah, I came back in May of 72.
Okay, so you came back to the States.
Yes.
In May of 72. What is it like for you to be a short-timer there?
Well, the new guys are coming again. We had a six-month cycle. where just about the time you come back from R&R, you're an old guy now. Mm-hmm. Now you're an old head. And the new guy starts showing up because all the other guys that were with you, they're all going home now. So now it's your turn to teach the new guys and pass the baton to them. So that was another factor that got you kind of going, is that you started having to worry about somebody else's abilities and passing it on to them.
What sort of lessons do you impart to the new guys?
I think pretty much lessons learned were know your rules of engagement, be familiar with what ifs, have a backup plan B and C all the time, be prepared for changes on the go. If a mission goes as planned, it's exceptional. Most missions don't go as planned. You just have to roll with the punches. Due to weather, facts, not being on station, a different ordnance load than you expected when you got to the airplane, things like that sometimes, you just had to roll with them and know what your limitations were. And depending on the weather, terrain, target, know what your capabilities were. Don't push it. Don't push it to areas that you were not familiar with. And if you had any questions, don't go. Don't do it.
Hmm. All right. So you finish up in Da Nang in May of 1972. Where do you go next? Take me home.
Okay, came home back to Travis. Came home on a charter. Had a 30-day leave. My wife at that time was back at Tampa, Florida. So I headed back there, packed up our household goods, got ready to move. My orders were to go to Holloman. It was Alamogordo, New Mexico. Took a couple of days, stopped and looked for a house. Knew that we were going to live off base, so we knew we had to find us a place to live. Made arrangements to buy a house while in the process of moving. So when we got to Alamogordo, we had a new house to arrive in, and that all took about 3 to 4 weeks to get that all done for that to happen.
Mm-hmm. Now, do you still keep up with what's going on in Vietnam?
Current today, 2014.
No, I'm sorry. When you came back from Vietnam and
we still had friends over there and buddies. Mm-hmm. Yeah, we did. 1972, pretty much kept track of it through the news and through intel briefings. The wing that I went to, the 49th TAC Fighter Wing, about the same time that I was moving in, they were deployed to Tok Lee. So they took the wing, 72 airplanes across the Pacific, and that's when Nixon reopened the bombing of the North for the final push, I guess, for the peace talks. And we were a NATO-committed wing that was supposed to go back to Germany, but instead they sent us to Southeast Asia. Tok Lee had closed, the 105s had left. When we got there, the runways were there, the buildings were hollow shells, and we had to reconstitute the base. So our Red Horse construction guys did a Superman job of getting a base back together in 2 weeks, getting us flying, getting the base ready. Meanwhile, I was settling in at Holloman. We had 6 airplanes that were left behind, and a small cadre of maintenance guys. So those 6 airplanes got airworthy, and then we exercised them and kept them flying locally until they decided that they needed us experienced guys to come over there. So in July, I left Holloman and went back to Southeast Asia to Tok Lee.
What was that like for you, Mr. Chisholm? I mean, you've done your one-year tour in Vietnam, flown all these missions, you're home, you buy a home, things are settling in, and all of a sudden you're being rerouted, as it were, to back to the war zone again. What was it like for you and your family?
Well, we definitely had a low point in morale.
Yeah.
It was definitely not a happy time. you know, your mindset is to get back to reality as the normal cycle of living, and then all of a sudden they come up and say, these are the Air Force and such, we need you to go over there. I was not alone, obviously. There was probably another dozen guys in the same boat that I was. We'd all completed our tours, come back, and, you know, we're settling in. And there was kind of talk about, nah, we're not going to go, we'll get sick, we'll fake it, and all that. But you're an officer, you have, you know, signed an oath to defend the Constitution and follow the orders of your superiors, so you knew you were obligated. Yeah, you didn't like it, nobody was happy with it, but you sucked it up and you did your job. So in July, we got on a 141 in Holloman and flew to Hawaii. And then from Hawaii, we flew into Thailand, dropped us off. And in 3 days, we were flying missions. Obviously, yeah, we had just come back, so there wasn't much orientation at all.
Yeah.
We just got assigned the various units that were there and filled in where they needed us.
And this would be a pretty busy time, too, I would assume.
We're busy because, again, they were looking for big missions up north, not four-ship airplane sorties, but 30, 35, 36 airplanes at a time from each wing, from each base, which was Tok Lee, Karat, Udorn, Uban. All these bases all supported these aircraft. Also, they were pulling out of Vietnam, so those bases in Vietnam are closing, and those airplanes were being moved to Thailand. The 366 gunfighters out of Da Nang, which I had flown with for 10 months, moved to Tok Lee. So we actually had two fighter wings at the base at the same time.
Hmm.
So we were very, very jam-packed full of aircraft, and a lot of the guys I knew were flying with them showed up, and we were integrated with those guys flying mixed sorties. So it wasn't just us flying out of the 49th, but we mixed the airplanes up with the 366. So
mm-hmm.
Rather interesting. Then there were guys from Seymour Johnson that came, George Air Force Base that came, and they filled in anywhere there were shorts on any of the other bases and wings. So there was a very, 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 very high percentage of the guys in the F4 community all there at the same time.
Mm-hmm. And normally when someone pulls two tours, you know, there's a time lag, and one of the questions I ask is, well, how would it change from the time you were there the first time to the second time? But in your case, you're talking May and then July, you're right back again. So I wouldn't think that it would have changed that much, had it?
No. I found no differences. all the procedures. The only thing that changed was where our targets were.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't work as much in countries we worked up north.
Yeah.
So our targets, instead of flying 4 days out of seven, you flew 3 days out of seven.
Yeah.
But the missions were much longer and bigger.
I wonder if you found it to be maybe not more satisfying, maybe that's the wrong word to use, but taking these missions to North Vietnam, I mean, was there an idea or a thought or a feeling that, hey, we're finally doing what we need to be doing, hitting these guys where they live?
I think so. Yes, I think you're correct in saying that. There was an accomplishment. There was a some sort of feeling of it's about time.
Mm-hmm.
You take the handcuffs off of us and let us do our jobs, and we'll show you that we are the best at it and anybody else can do it, and get this thing over with. And Our goals were to contain North Vietnam in North Vietnam. I don't think we ever, in our minds, wanted to invade the country or destroy the country. We just wanted them to sue for peace and secure South Vietnam in the way that we felt less threatened. The problem was is the domino theory from Eisenhower, that if you lose South Vietnam, you lose Laos, then you lose Cambodia, and then you lose Thailand, and it just marches on and on and on. And we had to draw the line in the sand, so South Vietnam was the line we drew. We didn't want to give it up. That, of course, changed, as we know. Under Nixon, they did not fulfill the obligation of supporting the country when they were re-attacked, and we did ultimately lose them. Cambodia and Laos kind of mingled along. They were purged by all kinds of different interests. Thailand, I think, was a success story. They were managed to be able to secure their borders and be affected very little politically by the outer influences of the Chinese and the Russians. But I think the South Vietnamese suffered greatly under our lack of support once the 1975 agreements came.
Yeah. Well, what did you think about the way the war was being prosecuted in general? You're a bright guy, an educated guy. You're an officer. You're paying attention to what's going on in the world. The way the war was being fought on the ground, in the air, in Hanoi, in Washington, in Saigon, what was your opinion of the way this war was being waged?
It was a frapped-up war.
Mm-hmm.
It was screwed. It was designed to lose. It was designed to, I guess, only be maintained as long as there's a profit to be made by the big interests. It was strictly what we could get out of it, as opposed to giving a place of democracy, a place to be born and grow. We were not committed. Our State Department did not commit to long-term occupation and training of the governments of South Vietnam and the surrounding countries. To say democracy and then don't prepare the people for democracy, don't educate the people, and don't give them the tools to maintain and prosper in a democratic society is a formula to fail. If you don't teach people to read and write, what good a balance? You've got to teach them the infrastructure to support the needs and the wants of their families. I would say that 90% of all mankind wants to live in some sort of safe environment where they can raise their family, have children, live to an old age, enjoy life. There's pretty basic needs and wants. And if you don't provide the tools to do that, it's not going to happen.
Do you think you were of this mindset back then?
Somewhat, but more. I think more just let's get by it, let's get through it. Somebody else's headache, not my headache to worry about.
Yeah.
Then as you get older, you realize it is your headache and there isn't anybody else. If you don't do it, it won't get done.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned that morale was a little low when you received orders to go back there later in 72. What was it like for you when you're seeing the U.S. draw down its commitment in Vietnam? The Vietnamese are trying to take up more of the fight. And, you know, this is a war. I mean, the handwriting's on the wall here. The U.S. is on its way out of Vietnam. And now you're being sent back to it. How does that affect your morale?
Definitely a drag. It's a wet blanket.
Mm-hmm.
All we do is buying time. The promise was that the Vietnamese are learning how to operate, and how to function as a fighting unit. But we knew that the troops themselves were inadequately trained, inadequately motivated. They didn't have a good NCO corps to teach the young soldier how to fight. They didn't have a good officer corps to lead and make strategic decisions, long-term plans. It was a kajmaj of CIA, Air America, contractors trying to patch weak points in the South Vietnamese structure to maintain some semblance of an organization. But once we walked out, once we shipped out, I think everybody agreed it was just a matter of time until it all fell apart.
Yeah. So you're here until October of 1972. You're a short-timer again. Take me through the process by which you come back to the United States.
Okay, we finally, in September, they decided the bombing was halted. I think the peace talks resumed, so they said, okay guys, you can head home. So we had to sit down and plan a redeployment back to the States. at this point we were there, so they used us older guys again to help select the crews, make up the people who are going to make up the echelons of aircraft, who's the flight lead, section lead, gaggle lead. Then maintenance had to coordinate to get the supplies to the bases, the staging bases. We were running from Thailand to Philippines, the Philippines to Hawaii, and then Hawaii into Holloman. So each of those stop points, we had to make sure that we had equipment on the ground and train guys to service the airplanes, place the bed down the troops for the night. The guys who flew today bed down tonight. Tomorrow we launch the crews to go follow the next guys. And once they landed, then those other guys took off. So it was a leapfrog all the way across the Pacific to come home with 72 airplanes. So
yeah.
It was rather lengthy. I'd say it took us 2 weeks at least to put it all together. Though that we had deployed several times the wing from the States to Germany, this is our first over the Pacific deployment that we had done. So it was rather a diligent task of detail and what are we going to do, what are we going to do, what if. There's not a lot of alternate landing spaces across the Pacific. So if you stick an airplane in the Midway Island, trying to get it out of there, getting it serviced, getting it repaired is a major, major undertaking.
Yeah.
So we had to prepare for all those contingencies, backup maintenance crews, a C-130 to stand by to haul tools, spare parts, and people should have to meet an airplane someplace that we weren't planned on going into. But it went very well. We didn't lose any airplanes. Nobody had equipment malfunctions serious enough to cause an airplane to get jettisoned. So we made it all back. We got 72 across and got 72 home.
Once you're home, do you still continue to follow the events in Vietnam?
Yeah, I'd say we did. We kind of watched it with a sort of semi-interest eye, but here again, we were now preparing for a rotation to Germany, and so our primary purpose in training now was to prepare for a cross-country over the Atlantic. We were going to go in a different piece and parts. We're only going to send two squadrons at a time. We would be there for a total of 60 days, but each squadron was only going to be there 30 days. So the first two squadrons went, got on the ground, two different bases, and then two squadrons followed 30 days later. For about 3 days, we had all 72 airplanes on the ground in Europe, for the NATO commitment. But we had, again, stage airplanes, stage crews, train up, backup crews. We used George as our primary support base for extra airplanes and people. Flew the whole wing to the East Coast. When I say the whole wing, I'm talking two squadrons at a time. We went originally to Seymour Johnson, got weather in there for a week. Weather was looking pretty bad because we were going in January, so they moved us down to Homestead, and we launched out of Homestead, so their weather wasn't as bad, the fog wasn't as bad, and the refueling tracks were better, so we left Homestead and went to Germany nonstop.
So for you, it goes Da Nang, home, back to Thailand, Tok Le, home briefly, and now you're going to Germany.
Yes.
And you just bought a house.
Yes.
So is this an unaccompanied tour for you?
No.
No.
No, it's accompanied.
Well, tell me about this tour in Germany.
Germany was TDY. The commitment was, the wing was a NATO-committed wing. They pulled squadrons out of four bases and brought them back to the States, and those four squadrons became the 49th Attack Fighter Wing. and we went back to the Europe to reconstitute all the forces that was committed to NATO, and they went to Ramstein, Hahn, Bitburg, Spandau. So that's where the four squadrons wound up for about 3 days overlap. The first two squadrons were Spangdahlem and Ramstein, and then the next two squadrons went to Bitburg and Hahn. So that, again, was busy. We had been trained in Southeast Asia tactics. We had started to get checked out in the European theater when we were in that 6-8 weeks of stateside between going back to Tak Lee. And then we came back home, and then it was November, December, January that we were trained up and certified to go to Europe. Different set of rules, different operating procedures. Europe, of course, was a NATO nuclear mission, whereas we had Southeast Asia was a conventional, different theater operation. So it was quite a changeover in thinking and strategy and operations.
Yeah. I wonder if you might tell me about that. What kind of differences are we looking at?
In Europe, you sit alert. Almost every base has at least four, maybe as many as 12 airplanes on alert. That means you have a real live nuke on board an airplane. It's tucked away in a shelter, a reinforced hangar, submerged in the side of a hill in a lot of cases, where they're pretty well protected with big glass doors. The idea, of course, was the Russians were going to come through East Germany with their armor, and then we were going to have to try to stop them at the, what they call the Folger Gap, in along the West German border. And the thoughts were that we were not going to have enough conventional forces to do that. We're going to have to nuke them. So that was our job, as the tactical nukes, to do that, stop the advance. Of course, we did do some flying, just the flying training, and that was pretty much navigational flights. And occasionally, since we had just come from Holland and where the weather was good and we could go to the range, we had dropped ordnance consistently, the continuity. But the German-based airplanes could not due to weather, so they would have to go TDY to Italy or down to Zaragoza, which was down in Africa, and they would go TDY for up to 30 days to get their qualifications to drop weapons, both the nuclear, simulated nuclear shapes and conventional, to get their certifications. So while we were sitting alert for them, they were going down and doing their training. So it was a interesting time frame, because we got there, it took 2 days to recover from the trip, and on the third day we sat alert. So it jumped in the fire pretty fast. There wasn't a whole lot of transition.
Yeah. What about the character, the makeup of the Air Force at this time? Following the Vietnam War, there were some shakeups that take place. You know, there were problems in terms of discipline and race issues and drug issues, things like that. How did the Air Force deal with these things post-Vietnam?
I'd say if you got caught with drugs, you're out. Didn't matter if you're an officer or enlisted guy. We called it the golden flow. We did a lot of sampling, urine sampling, no notice. And there were a lot of guys separated. Marijuana usage was rampant. Drug usage by the enlisted guys was pretty rampant. I don't know of any officer aircrew guys that got messed up in that stuff. Either we're lucky or we're smart enough not to get involved in it. I didn't know any potheads that flew airplanes.
Yeah.
We wouldn't trust them. If we knew about a guy, we'd somehow get him convinced that it's time for him to leave. I didn't know of any personal ones, so
yeah.
I can't speak from a personal experience. The Air Force was, of course, in 75, the war ended, and there was a big mass exodus. I left active duty in 75, went to the reserves, and served out my time for retirement in the reserves. So there was a lot of us that did that.
Why did you choose to get out?
Instability, not knowing what a career was, where we're going to be. I was 7 years on active duty. I was coming up for another assignment other than flying, and they couldn't tell me where that was going to be. They didn't know if we was going to go to school, or if we were going to go to a non-rated job, and I didn't know if it was going to be stateside, or if it was going to be overseas. All the uncertainties, and of course having a new family, we had just had a daughter, I just didn't feel I could really provide any kind of continuity for the next 10 or 15 years. I had no idea what I was going to be doing.
All right, now you get out, you say, in 1975, obviously the fall of Saigon in April of 75. What do you remember about that?
Very tragic. A lot of us felt kind of like, what did we waste our time? Why did we spend all that time? And, of course, the big question is the over 50,000 guys who never got to come home, all those lives lost. And if the 50,000 that were killed is probably 10 times that, with the tragic stories of the loss of loved ones and the upheaval of their families and all the other people that were impacted by that loss. So there's a lot of people at that time that were felt very, forsaken, I guess, useless, unappreciated in a lot of ways for the sacrifices they made. A lot of bitterness.
Retired, I guess you stayed with the National, or with the Reserve. What did you do with your life after the active duty Air Force?
I went to a management job with Orkin Pest Control. Ran branches and districts for them, and spent 25 years in that industry, and retired from that.
When you get the opportunity, do you still read books on the Vietnam War? You watch movies?
Oh, yeah.
Documentaries, anything like that?
Matter of fact, a lot of us, when we get together, wonder where all of these sagas of World War II, I mean, they had hundreds of movies with John Wayne and all these guys. When did the Vietnam War get publicized? But I guess we've seen the publicity that we're going to get. It's over. The war is forgotten and buried. I guess Korea is the other one that a lot of guys ask about. Where did that war go? The sacrifices those guys made. But I think it's just going to go fade away into history, and it'll be just a footnote. That's all it's going to be.
What about movies? Do you watch Vietnam-era movies?
Yeah, but there aren't very many that cover the war. And if they do, they're kind of rebellious, and they're very slanted in their presentations, just some of the ones with Tom Cruise, to think about the Wounded Warriors. I guess Gomer with Tom Hanks, Gump, was kind of a parody on the war. It kind of made the war kind of a funny thing, but there wasn't a lot of humor in Vietnam.
Well, I've got just a couple more questions for you. First off, when you look back at your experiences in Vietnam, how do you think they most affected your life?
Well, it proved to me that I could do a job, uphold my commitment, my promise to my country. I enjoyed the camaraderie of the guys. Most of the time when you're thinking about why you did things, it was because of your fellows. I think your fellow soldiers and warriors, you didn't want to let them down. You wanted to do a good job for their purpose and their survival. And, of course, there's patriotism that gets involved also. Your country's asked you to do a job, and I think your responsibility as a citizen is to do that if that's so you're choosing. You have to do it. And Vietnam, again, it's a maturity. is seeing the world, and seeing other things, and seeing where other people live, appreciate what we have in our own country. As screwed up as we are, there's a lot of other places in the world screwed up a lot worse than us.
That's for sure. Well, the last question I have for you is a rather broad one, but we oftentimes look back to the Vietnam War and say, well, here's the lesson we should have learned, here are the lessons we did learn. What do you think, as you look back on it, what do you think is the lessons of the Vietnam War? What is the lasting legacy of the Vietnam War?
I think if America commits to a job, we must do it completely and not half-ass.
Mm-hmm.
It's got to be done totally with our resources, with our energies, with our technology. If we promise the people to help them, then by God, we got to help them. If not, what good is our society? What good is our word? We've got to stand up. If we know it's right, we have to make it so that they can make their adjustments. Our democracy doesn't work everywhere else in the world. They have to have modifications, adjustments in their way of doing things that makes them happy. And we have to be smart enough to let them do that. Not everybody likes vanilla ice cream. There are those that like chocolate, strawberries, whatever else. So we've got to understand that there's more than one way to do things. I think the betterment of man is that we all live in peace. I have no problem having a Negro next door, an Italian on the other side, and a Polack across the street, and, you know, an Arab, you know, down the block. I just don't want them all in my front yard. I don't want them to tell me that I have to eat certain things or wear certain clothes. If you leave me alone, I'll leave you alone. If you want to come visit, hey, my door is open. Come on and visit. And the same thing I think should be returned back to me. So if we can do that and we can accept that, give us our space and give us our freedoms without, you know, trying to take away our space, that's what we got to learn. We got to learn to live with each other.
Well, is there anything else you'd like to add before we bring the interview to a close?
I think we did a good job. Hopefully I've answered your questions and given you a little insight of what I've done in my life and during the Vietnam War and how I survived it. And hopefully our next generations will do a better job than we did.
All right, very good.